Thanks for listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's only progressive talk station. Now, coming to you live from the banks of the Willamette River, it's Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman.
You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value.
Online at 620kpoj.com and on the air at AM 620 KPOJ.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm Women Liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. And that was Gilbert Scott Heron, known as Gil Scott Heron. He was an American poet, a musician, and an author known primarily for his spoken word performances in the 1970s and 80s. What you just heard is his most popular piece entitled The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. He died last week on May 27th. Rest in peace, brother. Rest in peace. So we're talking about the 60s. We're talking about building a truth to power movement or rebuilding a truth to power movement. And there is no better target. We're also saying, where are the targets? Where are the lunch counters of today? Where do we focus our attention? Well, there is no better place to focus our attention, I think, than on corporate personhood. Our next guest is Rick Staggenborg, who has dedicated, he is a local Oregon. I guess he bounces back to California sometimes. But he has dedicated his life to repealing corporate personhood, and he is here with an update. Rick, thanks for being on the show. Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America.
Thanks for having me on, Adam.
That Gil Scott Heron thing, man, that just gets me every time.
Yeah, I wish people would understand the revolution will not only be, not be televised, but it isn't going to be behind the computer screen either.
No, you're right.
Get out on the streets.
Right, even in Egypt, man, they saw what they saw on their computer screen, but they got into the street. And that's, you can organize on the computer, but it's boots on the ground, it's feet on the ground, it's hearts and minds changing the way we think in this country. So you're here to give us an update on the work you've been doing to abolish corporate personhood. You've got an article that you've submitted to The Nation. called Ending Corporate Plutocracy. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the content of that article and what's going on?
Well, basically, it's the outline of what I've had in mind all along for the best way to get a constitutional amendment not only into Congress, but then use the amendment, support for the amendment, as a campaign litmus test so that we can see who's the corporate tools and who wants to work for us. Anybody that'll support it will get my vote.
Well, let's go back a minute. I probably should ask this question first, which is, why don't you just define what corporate personhood is and how it is affecting our democracy?
Well, different people will define it different ways, but the way most people think of it is it's the idea that corporations have constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment. And so one of those rights, supposedly, is the right to free speech, which the Supreme Court has defined as giving as much money as you want to help elect the tools of your choice.
So the Supreme Court has upheld the idea. It's been in force for a long time, but the Supreme Court recently upheld the idea with the Citizens United case that corporations have the same rights as persons. And one of the things that people need to remember is corporations have something that actual persons don't. They have limited liability, whereas we do not. So they exist in perpetuity and we die. So you're dealing with an entity that now has the same rights as certainly to free speech as real persons, but they have limited liability and they exist in perpetuity, which gives them a tremendous advantage over actual living persons. Do I have it right, Rick?
That's right.
Okay, so in your there's some skepticism about whether or not we should be introducing an amendment. People are calling for like a Continental Congress type of event, a constitutional convention, rather than an amendment. Talk to me about this debate and why do you feel that the idea of a constitutional convention is not the right idea and an amendment is?
Well, personally, I think we should work on both, but people are stretched pretty thin. So if they're going to devote themselves to one of those efforts, I would certainly encourage them to get a petition signed calling on their personal congressman and senator to introduce amendments in each house. The reason is that if you randomly quiz people about whether they like the idea of a constitutional convention, a substantial proportion of both conservatives and liberals will say, "Oh, my God, no. That'll lead to socialism," or conversely, "That'll lead to fascism." So, and we haven't done.
I mean, a constitutional convention will lead to socialism or fascism?
Well, in a constitutional convention, everything's wide open. You can propose as many changes as you want.
I see.
Whereas an amendment in Congress can be as specific or as broad as you want, but the whole Constitution isn't wide open to reinterpretation.
Now, is there an amendment drafted somewhere in the mix of this country that's waiting to be introduced?
Well, there's probably several amendments. The one that's most well-known is Donna Edwards, and her amendment would give Congress the power to regulate corporations. However, because most of Congress is basically elected by corporations, they won't use that power, just like they don't use the war power to prevent the president from sending us into combat when there's no reason for it except corporate profit and empire.
Well, so what would a win represent? So say that we succeeded in introducing and passing an amendment abolishing corporate personhood. Where would we stand then?
Well, it would mean that corporations can't contribute to campaigns, period, in any way, shape, or form, directly or indirectly. And that means that we would have to come up with another way to get the money together to elect these people. And hopefully they won't have enough money to run their whole campaigns on television propaganda ads. Hopefully that means that they'll have to get out and do what we used to do when we were running for office, talk to the people.
Yeah, it seems that that would be a great step towards real election reform and starting to get the money out of politics. I think in Canada, I may have it wrong, and maybe Zach can help me out. I think in Canada, corporations are just flat out not allowed to contribute to political campaigns at all. That would be a great start in this country. I mean, what did we spend? What was it? $2 billion, $4 billion for Barack Obama's campaign in 2010? I mean, as long as we have to spend that kind of money, I think it's indicative of a system that's just overrun and sick and toxic with too much money and not enough principle. I mean, we know that money subverts principle. That's one of the things it does best.
Right. Well, one of the things I'd like to point out is that there are a lot of people that say, well, we should go for electoral reform first. My question is, who's going to pass it? Who wants to give up their advantages? Not a majority in either the state or federal legislatures. So this is really the only choice we have, is to force them to give up the corporate backing that gets them elected. I mean, look at the clowns we've got in the Senate in particular, and look at the clowns that are running for candidates in the Republican Party. It's a joke. How can these people possibly be taken seriously because they own the corporate media?
Now, did you make some progress with Representative Kucinich? You had a conversation with him about dropping an amendment, and he was open to that idea?
Well, I didn't actually have a conversation. I was at the Green Festival in Seattle a couple weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to ask him the question in front of several hundred people, whether he would help us get together a coalition of senators and congressmen who would jointly introduce the amendment. That would protect them from being personally attacked, at least individually attacked, by corporate money. And I think that it's actually a great campaign tool. That's what I based my campaign on. I mean, if people know you're not going to take corporate money to run, and the first thing you want to do is introduce that constitutional amendment, they're going to pay attention. That'll get buzz. You don't even need to spend $1 million on it on ads. So I'm advising several people to do that. We've got somebody in Portland who's going to be running without corporate money on a pledge to amend against David Wu. So that should be a very interesting fundraiser.
Yeah, he called in. I was on Carl Wolfson's show yesterday, and he called in and talked about it. And I want him to call me. I'd love to have him on the show to talk a little bit more about that. Rick Stagenborg is our guest, who is a political activist, also a psychologist, and someone who has really dedicated his life to abolishing corporate personhood. Where are some websites? Give us some places people can go to get involved with this whole movement, Rick.
Well, I recommend Move to Amend because they have a broader...
MoveToAmend.org, is that right?
.org. They have a broader approach than the other big group, which is Public Citizen. Unfortunately, they don't get as much attention. They do have a petition online that's got 110,000 signatures. I'd like to see that go to 1 million. We would like to work with Public Citizen, but they restrict themselves strictly to the First Amendment provisions of this Supreme Court series of rulings, and we think that there's other problems too. They also have power under the Fourth Amendment to avoid search and seizure, surprise inspections without a warrant. There's a lot of other potential advantages they could have. They're allowed to lie to the public, like in the Nike case.
Right, Rick. That is my music. So I got to run. But thanks so much for being on the show, Rick Stagenborg. Has been our guest, a dedicated activist to the abolition of corporate personhood. MoveToAmend.org is the site. Rick, thanks for being on the show.
You bet. Thank you, Adam.
When we come back, we are going to talk to Jason Ben-Levy. His book, Too Much Magic, is about how venture capital, media moguls, and marketeers are using digital magic to distract us, invade our privacy, corrupt democracy, and a whole lot of other bad stuff. We'll be right back.
Maddening. Isn't it? This is Mad as Hell in America. Portland's Progressive Talk, 620 KPOJ.
Now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And that's why woe is us that Edward George Ruddy died. So you listen to me. Listen to me. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You eat like the tube. You raise your children like the tube. You even think like the tube. This is mass madness, you maniacs. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's only progressive talk station. And that was, of course, Howard Beale in the Movie Network talking about the mystification of television and how it has supplanted our reality. Of course, that was 35 years ago, before the computer revolution, before we had iPads and video games and iPods and tablets and reality TV and 186,000 channels. But I certainly think it's relevant to our next guest, whose name is Jason Ben-Levy. Jason Ben-Levy has spent decades as a marketing communications guru working in the leading technology companies in Silicon Valley and beyond. As a creative director, a speechwriter, and a script writer for companies like Apple, Microsoft, Sun, HP, Sony, Sega, and Cisco, he helped sell the dream of the digital life, and that is the digital life that I've been talking about in the first hour that keeps us asleep, that seems to somehow paralyze our political volition. He has written a tremendous new book. I'm about three-quarters of the way through it and just absolutely loving it. I wished I could have finished it, and I'm going to finish it this week. It is a tremendous book called Too Much Magic. It is the story of how venture capital, media moguls, and marketeers use digital magic to distract us, invade our privacy, corrupt democracy, distort our human values, and sell us things we don't need. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. Stay with us the whole hour with Jason Ben-Levy. Jason, welcome to Mad as Hell in America.
Thank you.
You have written a tremendous book. And one of the things that struck me right away about the book, Too Much Magic, and you can get it at TooMuchMagic.net, TooMuchMagic.net, is you are also a writer. So it is exquisitely well written, because sometimes when people kind of defect as you have and tell their stories are compelling, but the writing isn't. Both the story and the writing are compelling. So thanks for writing such an important book, and I'm thrilled you're here.
Well, thank you for saying such kind things about it.
Well, I feel it enthusiastically. I was telling my wife about it. So first of all, before we get into the title of the book and why you called it what it is, just tell us a little bit about your background. And this is going to be a short segment, but we have the whole hour sure. with Jason Ben-Levy. So tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll get into the book in the next
sure.
section.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you started your first hour about the 60s, because I was one of those kids who was set up to be one of the science kids with the space program and all of that. And then the Vietnam War happened, and I saw the results of what science was doing, and it didn't look like what I wanted to be doing, which was blowing things up and being part of the military establishment.
Right.
So right away I thought, well, that's not really what I want to be doing, so I headed toward a more creative direction and tried to find the expression of myself that way. But secretly, all the rest of the time, I was still a techie. Still experimenting with everything electronic I could get my hands on. Kept it secret from my creative friends. But apparently I wasn't the only one doing that, because there were people like Steve Jobs and other folks in Silicon Valley who were kind of a rebel class that were coming into existence from what had been the old computing corporate world. Suddenly there were the parts available to go and build a computer yourself and do creative, interesting things with it that were not part of the normal corporate computing. And in doing so, people could empower themselves to do things that were different.
And so you grew up in the Silicon Valley area, the Bay Area, is
that
right?
Well, actually, I grew up in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And came up to go to college here and found a lot of kindred souls. I was in film school and also programming computers at the same time, and there weren't too many people back when I was doing that.
And then your professional life was, what was it about?
Basically, it's akin to advertising. It's marketing communications, which is if someone is launching a new product, they'll need some videos. They'll need a kind of creative kernel to express what that is, and then some sort of event or an ad campaign. And I kind of wind up trying to come up with that central idea that will help sell that to the general public. And it involves working with people who are technical in the first place and kind of translating into stuff that regular folks can understand.
So you're kind of a techie creative type who was attracted to the kind of tech movement that was going on in the 70s and in the 80s, because it seemed to me that it was a lot about personal empowerment. I mean, certainly Steve Jobs and that whole movement was about moving away from, you know, IBM and moving towards giving people the power to kind of personally compute. Am I right?
Exactly. And even the origins of the web in the early 90s were really more about, I mean, the very early internet was military, but when it started being the web, it was really about institutions sharing information, about being able to have a library or share documents among people who are in academia.
We're talking to Jason Benlevy, author of a book, Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. He's kind of a defector, worked in helping big companies sell the mystification of tech, and now has written a book about how we need to take a second look at this. You can learn more about his book at toomuchmagic.net. He is our guest for the rest of the hour, so stay with us. This conversation is going to get very interesting. There's a lot you want to know. This is Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. You're listening to AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's only progressive talk station. We are talking to Jason Benlevy, who has written a new book called Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. TooMuchMagic.net is the website where you can learn more about the book. It is a tremendous book and an important book, and a conversation that we're not having that's consistent with how we seem to just embrace technology without any kind of thoughtful, meaningful conversations about the implications. Let's just take, I don't know, nuclear energy for one, or the bomb for another, or automobiles, or oil extraction, or any of the technologies that just, like, it's all good, let's go. So, Jason, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've established, at least in my mind, that you're a defector, that you're once you're somebody who works in the computer tech industry as a creative, who helps message, and that kind of has helped sell what you call the digital life. Is that
right?
A fair assessment?
Well, I'd say that I'm not a defector. I'm someone who's trying to illuminate people to start the conversation going. That is, I don't think technology is inherently bad. I think that some of the people, some of the visions that are being promoted are negative. That, again, we started with the idea that this was stuff for personal empowerment. And then along the line, most likely around probably about 1995, when we went from the web, as an example, being a academic curiosity and things to share information, to the dawn of Netscape and the big IPOs, suddenly an entirely different class of people were interested in technology. Before, it was a lot of interesting engineers, curious people, hobbyists, creative types. And then we moved over to this merchant class.
And it became a gold rush.
And it became a gold rush.
Which is what it is now.
So
I'll come clean with you. I love gadgets. I'm a technology guy.
Right.
I'm as mystified as the next guy. And I'm the guy who's, you know, I'm not the guy who actually waits in line for the iPhone. But, yeah, I'm definitely one of the early adopters. you know, and I'm always extolling the convenience. You know, I use my Safeway Club card. I'm like, look at all this money I saved, you know. And I got to be honest. I'm one of these people that's just completely embraced what you're calling magic. So the title of your book, Jason Ben-Levy, is Too Much Magic. TooMuchMagic.net is the website. Why? What do you mean by too much magic? Why did you call it too much magic?
Well, I think the problem that we've run into is that we've become extremely dependent on it. And yet we're not really aware of what's happening in the background of it. Like, as an example, you like your Safeway card and going and getting, saving a couple cents on whatever you're buying or a couple dollars. But every time you swipe that card, you are adding yourself to a database that says what you are buying, creates a profile of you, and that information is sold to a data aggregator that starts assembling a profile of you.
And where is that information?
Well, there's actually a few companies that consolidate all this information. Most of them were started by the original credit bureaus. And because credit bureaus were limited by the government as to what kind of information they could collect about you, they formed secondary companies that could collect any kind of information and have no government oversight.
So it's kind of sitting there, and if somebody wanted to construct a profile from the information, it would be easy enough.
Right, and basically it's a business. The idea is that you go and if you want to find people who are who buy a certain kind of medicine or a certain kind of car or whatever, you go and ask these at data aggregators to give you a set of people, their names, phone numbers, whatever information, so you can go and market to them.
I'm going to read a little quote from your book here, talking about buy-in. And I'm somebody who, got to be honest with you, I'm just totally bought in. I love it. But your book is giving me pause. I think that's why I love it so much. It's like, wake up, Adam. the digital revolution has everything a good magic act should have. Deft moves, misdirections, and technically achieved illusions. There is no shortage of deceptive practitioners with an income generation potential that is unlike anything we have ever seen. Slowly in steps, you are buying in. Every facet of human life has become a tech encounter. Dating, sending letters, banking, taking pictures, making movies, and selling music have all gone digital. Digital magic is becoming central to your life, your job, your spare time, and your relations with your family. Even voting has become digitized, and I think my listeners are aware of that. Then you say something important. The fundamental problem is that when we adopt a digital technology into our lives, we introduce a medium to facilitate it. And that seems to be one of the key dangers you talk about. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. And this is something that's starting to come to the fore when we talk about net neutrality. When we first started having internet connections, there were lots of little teeny companies that you can get your internet access from. And they were all little independent companies. And the idea is that you had an open spigot to the whole internet, as much as you can drink from whatever source you wanted. We have come to a point where we've moved down to three or four companies that really pretty much control the internet in this country. And one of those companies, Comcast, actually went and bought a content company. Now, if you think about that...
For our listeners, tell them which content company
they
bought.
No, the company they bought was NBC.
Right.
Now, you could say at first, okay, well, they can go and prefer to shove their own shows down there at a faster speed than the other ones because it's their company and they can do what they want. But they also could go and decide to not show you everything that's available on the internet. You can go and do a search and have addresses blocked. You could have progressive news sites, as an example, pushed down to such a slow speed that you think that they're not working or they can disappear entirely.
So the point is that these mediums, every time we buy in, and it seems to me that what you're saying is with every swipe, with every check we scan with our iPhone and send to our bank, with every digital participation that we make, that we are empowering this medium, which can then control our behavior, the information we get, build profiles about us. I mean, and this isn't science fiction stuff. This is what's happening.
Right, and it's as subtle as your car actually keeping a record of your driving habits.
Right, they have this thing, the progressive. There's a profile, right? If you're a good driver, you can put something in your car and then you can drop your insurance rate. So that sounds great.
Right, except it's in every car and people don't know about it.
I mean, it's in every car right now.
It's been in cars since the introduction of seatbelts. And again, it's kind of like, or rather airbags. And at first it was really a good idea, like a lot of technologies, which is they wanted to find out how effective seatbelts were,
right.
Airbags were. And so they wanted some sort of data. And then it was very easy just to keep accumulating more data about your driving habits, whether you were speeding where you were, add in your GPS data now,
right.
And pretty soon you have quite a profile that's assembled. Now, one of the tricks here is you don't own that information.
Right.
Because it's all encoded, and you can't access it.
You talk in the book about this idea that we just seem to be embracing the good but not having a conversation about the implications. So I think you use the example of the internet and blogging and how it seems to be this wonderful tool for political empowerment, but there's a downside to this kind of digital aspect of political dissemination of message.
Right. And digital democracy, you know, we're hearing a lot about digital democracy with what's called the Arab Spring.
Right.
Because we have this ability to receive reports from where the regular media cannot penetrate. So people are there with their cameras and their phones and sending information back to us, which is a good thing. Of course, one of the problems with that is that we can't verify that any of that is true, and it would be very easy to send a false story when we don't have any way of independently verifying. But in addition, those people who are using those phones can become targets themselves. In Iran, the Iranian Revolution, people were using their phones and to communicate and Twitter, and it became, because the Iranian government pretty much controlled the phone company, it was very easy to find all the dissenters.
So, in essence, if you're on the internet or you're using it, there is no privacy anymore. I mean, if somebody wants to find you or find out what you're buying or find something out about you and you're participating in this digital life, as you call it, it's there. There is no privacy anymore, essentially.
No, and there's even a generational divide on this where those of us who are my age and your age think that, God, we'd like to keep some of our privacy.
Sure.
But for people who are teenagers who are used to sharing this and now are in their 20s, who engage in things that are even check in when they go to a restaurant, so they tell their friends where they're eating, or have other kind of social network GPS-based systems, you know, they're kind of tracking where their friends are all the time. And that could be good, but it's also kind of creepy.
We're talking to Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. So let's try to get in before the break. TooMuchMagic.net, where you can buy the book and find out more. Let's talk about, you talk about the seven aspects of digital life. Is that relevant at this point in the conversation?
I think it is. I can just go over them really quickly, okay. Which is that digital technologies have given us the ability to have pervasive entertainment, which is when you were a kid, you could watch a show on TV and that was it, or you can go to the movies and that was it. That was your opportunity. Now we have the ability to watch anything at any time. Think about if you have kids, how often they will go and watch that same DVD over and over again. That was certainly something that you could not do before. But now we're going and taking that experience and we're putting it in the back seat of the family van. So those kids, instead of being part of the family trip and, you know, interacting with their parents in this nice little capsule where we can all be together, are busy watching yet another cartoon or another movie that they've already seen.
So what's another aspect of the digital life? You have seven. What are the key?
So mobile technology, which is obviously one that we're all experiencing both the convenience and inconvenience. At first, we loved having cell phones because it allowed us, or at least we had the excuse that if there was an emergency, we could be in contact with someone. But then we started getting kind of rude about them and started using them in restaurants, invading other people's space with it. And we know that the single largest incidents or the single largest problem we're having with people driving is distraction. And the single largest distraction is cell phones. And it's not a matter of having the phone in your hand. It's a matter of your mind not being on the road.
Right, right. So you use this term in the book, digerati. Is that your term?
No, digerati is a term that is proudly embraced by people who are part of this.
Who are those people? They don't sound good.
Okay. Well, they're part of what
I don't call, like their name.
Yeah, well, they're part of what I call the cult of tech, which is the subtitle of the book.
Right.
And it's really kind of a convergence of digerati are it's basically a convergence of investors, technologists, marketeers, and journalists. And they're people who really relentlessly promote the digital lifestyle, mainly because they have invested in it, either as investors or that their career is tied to it, like journalists who perhaps are technology journalists are not going to go and say really bad things about, they may say a bad thing about one product, but they're not going to say that we're on the wrong path.
Right. So let me ask you this. I want to ask you two questions. We might have to carry it over into the break.
Sure.
What frightens you the most about what's happening with the emergence of this digital life and all this buy-in that's going on?
Well, I think the most frightening thing is to watch people who are younger who have become so enormously dependent on these intermediaries that can't go and make a date with each other without going and checking each other out on Facebook first, and that we are losing that ability to have an ambient experience, that every moment has us in front of a screen. Even the way we would go and look at the news, our world is narrowing because we're going to go and look at it on our computer screen and we're going to go to the story that we want to find. And yet when we have a newspaper, we have open up a newspaper and it's kind of random. And you're seeing things that are outside of your experience. So we have this really bubble effect, this narrowing happening on us, and that it makes us not very dimensional, both in the sense that we're looking at the world on a screen all the time, but also not dimensional, being open to new things and not sensing the ambient life that's going on around us, which makes us more impersonal, more disconnected, and again, very dependent on this technology to connect us to the only connection that we have left.
Well, see, that's what frightens me the most, is when I see my own dependence growing on it. And I kind of, somewhere I think I know this, well, you know, so they're going to be able to track me, so what, that the convenience of it is so seductive. And yet, just like every other industry that's emerged, that's become incredibly powerful in this country, there is lots of money and lots of minds and lots of energy organizing just behind all of that convenience. And that's one of the things that I took away from your book, Jason Ben-Levy, author of a book, Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech, TooMuchMagic.net. is the website. You can stay with us. Maybe we'll take some calls. 503-248-0620, 1-866-452-0620. If you want to join this conversation about pulling the plug on the cult of tech, this is Mad as Hell in America. We'll be right back.
They won't give peace a chance. There was just a dream some of us had.
Welcome back to Mad as Hell in America with Adam Klugman. I'm your host, Adam Klugman. This is AM 620 KPOJ, Portland's only progressive talk. We are talking with Jason Ben-Levy, author of the book Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And it seems to fit very neatly in with the theme that we're talking about in general, which is how do we reclaim an active, vital, fierce truth to power movement in this country like we did in the 1960s. Jason, welcome back to the show.
It's a little harder to be mad as hell after hearing Joni Mitchell.
I know, but I'm trying to pick songs that are of that whole era, man. I love that tune. So, Jason, one of the things you bring up in the book is I think, very interesting about how we just embrace technology with open arms, unquestioningly, particularly digital technology, and yet our whole mythology is about this dystopic future in which technology runs our lives. What are we trying to tell ourselves?
You know, it's really interesting because I'm kind of an amateur film historian and have gone way back in time on watching movies, and it's almost impossible to find a movie about the future that shows it all working. And it's not, in most cases, it's not because of the stuff, even though the stuff is part of it. It's usually because there's some central governing authority figure. Often it could be a corporate one in things like Metropolis. It can be governmental, but in each case, the dehumanization takes place. And
that is the theme, right? The theme is that, and this is what you touched on last hour, that there's a dehumanization that takes that is taking place that we're not aware of with each new buy-in. So we don't have a lot of time. So there's two questions I want to ask you in the time that we have left. And the first one is, you know, it seems to me with major technology booms, we fail to have the conversation about what are the implications of automobiles, what is the implication of nuclear power. You know, we never seem to have the conversation along with the development of the technology. We just embrace it as good with the tech boom, with the digital life. And we only have about 2.5 minutes here, a minute and a half. What conversation should we be having?
Well, you know, as you were saying, we wind up developing technologies really quickly because and lagging in the sociology. So we always get the tech and then the sociology kind of sort of follows.
Right.
And the reason why is because the tech and the products are what makes the money. And the people who are driving this are really just looking for products to sell.
Right.
Without regard to what the social impact is.
So what should be the content of the conversation we should be having? If someone gave you, here's $100 million, I want you to start a conversation about the importance and the implications of technology. Where would you start?
I think that people have to look at themselves and decide whether this thing fits in their life, how it's going to change them. They really, really have to look at their kids, that their kids are not exhibiting advanced behavior just because they're using technology, because they're just users. They're not building it. They're not making it themselves. And so we need to start moving people over to realizing that it starts with kids and hold back some of the technology until they're older.
We have been speaking with Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Jason, thank you very much for being on the show. If you want to get the book, go to TooMuchMagic.net. TooMuchMagic.net. Read this book. It's a ripper. It will blow your mind. You will be really glad that you did.